This is Japan Baseball Weekly, the only English podcast covering all 12 NPB teams. And now, your hosts, John E. Gibson and Jim Allen.
Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly podcast. It's for the week of August 16th. I'm John Gibson, and with me on a cool, rainy, wet, nasty, seems like it's starting to be fall evening on Sunday, is Jim Allen. What's happening, man? I'm not complaining. Yes, I am. Well,
I'm not certain how to tell the difference when you're not complaining.
You're right.
you forgot autumnal. I think you need a new thesaurus, but I'm doing well.
I didn't sign up for this. I want my summer back. It was like we just skipped summer. Skipping summer. And I know it's going to get warmer a little bit. Like we're going to look back on this in a week and say, haha. But right now it's cold. I got long pants on. The windows are closed because it was too cold. I don't like that. Not in August.
Suck it up.
All right. Yeah. I will. We got a lot of stuff going on today, so I'm going to jump right in. Except for before we start with the JBW stuff, I must say this. We normally let the big league guys take over when our MPB players, quote unquote, graduate and move on to the majors. But Shohei Ohtani facing the guy against whom he's basically battling for the major league lead in home runs and the MVP honor, and he pitches against him on the mound. And he has a chance to keep him from hitting, a long ball. And then Ohtani himself gets to swing and has his chance to get a home run. And that was one of the coolest things I've ever seen in baseball. And that happened this past week. And you usually see the two home run leaders in the same game. And their teammates are on the mound. And they're hoping that their teammates don't give up a home run to the guy who they're chasing. But in this case, Ohtani was the guy facing the guy who's chasing him. It was just wacky and awesome. And I'm really enjoying what Ohtani is doing in the major leagues this year. And we have refrained from talking about him at all because, like I said, we let these guys move on to the major leagues. But man, oh man, this is fun.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we should because, I mean, when before they went to the major leagues, all the major league talking heads, pretended like, they knew everything. So, they know everything. They knew everything then. They know everything now. Who cares what we think?
Well,
I mean, there's not I tried to keep all the spite out of that, but
I think some got through. I'm not sure. Well, I'll have to check the tape in the editing process.
Yeah, John's got a spite filter. Hopefully, we'll see if it works or not.
It's out at the shop with my crystal ball.
Well done.
Great stuff. Great stuff. So look, on this week's show, we've got a chat with former Yonko player and now scout for the Swallows, Aaron Guile. We're going to discuss the return of baseball, the regular season has resumed, and much more, so let's start swinging.
Clearing the bases!
All right, remember to mask up and hunker down out there, and as the numbers spike here in Japan, we just got to somehow avoid this Delta variant and all the things that go with that, but on Thursday night, Japan time, I sat down and talked to Aaron Guile, who was up early in Arizona for us. We spoke by phone and, we're still working to get some current Yakult Swallows players on the show. That's a work in progress. I hope Jim is making some headway, hint, hint. But it's always good to sit down and take a 30,000 foot view, let's say, of the team. And Aaron Guile gave us a little bit of that as he joined us for some insight about the Swallows. And we had him on the show in October last year. And basically in this chat, he gives us a different angle of skipper Shingo Takatsu and maybe a management take on the team's success so far. So let's take a listen. All right. So we are joined by Aaron Guile, a scout for the Yakult Swallows. How's it going? Good morning to you.
Good morning, Johnny. Yeah, no, everything's going well. It was nice to talk to you today.
Yeah, great to have you on the show. Thank you very much for your time. Always appreciate it. So how is the scouting world going?
It's great to be in the game. It's great for a team like the Swallows, an organization I played with, it's great to be a part of that. And, just to, just just to have the baseball, but it's just such an unusual time that, you know, how scouting was done, you know, pre-pandemic and how it was done 10 years ago is done quite a bit differently now. So, we're doing the best we can with lockdowns and restrictions on ballparks and just the realignment of Major League Baseball and minor league systems, but we're doing the best we can to get out there and look at players, you know, to continue to help, you know, the Swallows up there. So it's, they've been great as and being flexible. But, you know, there's times we can't get out to the ballpark, so we have to stream games or, you know, I'm working with Tony Barnett. We just met, you know, had a long meeting yesterday about players and just trying to gather information. So I'd like to say it's going well. And I still love and enjoy what I do, but I think this year it's been a little bit challenging to try to, you know, really do our job. But, you know, we're doing the best we can so that if there is a need with our team, then, you know, we're giving them as much information as we can.
Right now, how's everything going right now in terms of you've got to divide your attention between having a backup plan for this season in case someone gets hurt, I would imagine, and then looking at maybe needs or areas that you want to identify and address for next season as well. How do you divide that time?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a challenge, but it's something that we're all prepared for. So with Michael Okamura, who's our director with the Swallows, and Tony and myself, we always have two focuses that we do. And this is the same if we're going to, we're always building through the offseason. But if we're looking at players, even going back to spring training, we have kind of two focuses. One is do we need, you know, looking for players that we need, you know, mid-season additions to our team. And the other is when the season is over and, you know, we might potentially be looking to add a player that will no longer be with our team. We're looking at that. So that's the challenge for, you know, scouts for like Tony and I to say, hey, who's going to be available or could be available if we have somebody get injured, go down, or not perform, and then the off season. So the challenge with us is to see go through the list of players and say, well, who actually wants to leave the United States and go to Japan? Who's performing at that level that is going to be going to be helpful for our team? And also for Tony and I to go out and look and say, well, who fits with the Yakult team, the chemistry, what we look for, and things like that. So that's really where our skill set comes in. And going out and trying to find that player. So, you know, fortunately, the Swallows have been playing well this year. We had two, you know, position player additions that, you know, we're very excited about that are doing well. They're fitting in well on the field, but also just as importantly, they're fitting in well with the clubhouse and the chemistry. So I think you're seeing that benefit. You know, on the pitching side, I think it's been a little bit inconsistent, and I think we'd like to see our guys improve on that. So it's with that. So I think if we're looking, you know, we're looking to motivate those guys. It's not part of my job, but, you know, hopefully those guys find a way to improve. But, you know, that would be, if we're looking at a focus, you know, right now, I think, I don't think we're going to be incredibly active before the deadline. I think we're mainly going to be looking to have our guys, you know, just step it up a little bit.
Okay. So, yeah, you brought in Jose Osuna and Domingo Santana. Both of those guys, I guess if you mesh their numbers together, they're both around 300 and you're getting the power production. Now, neither one seems to be frustrated by the off-speed pitches or timing or all the other traps that imports struggle with in MPB. Why is that, you think?
Well, it just depends. You know, the type of player, everybody, all the players are slightly different in their approach. Their strengths and weaknesses. And one thing about when you do come to Japan is a lot of players have success at the beginning. You know, if you come and you're a high-quality AAA player in the United States, we know that you're going to have that potential to be successful on both sides of the Pacific. But as far as both them coming to Japan, what I've found and what I experienced, what I've seen is that players bring that skill set there, and they're coming for a reason because they do have talent. They are good players. It is not a development situation. You have to step in and you have to perform right away, and that's what's expected of you. So I think both players are quality players. They definitely are. I think what happens is the difference between a player coming to Japan, I think most players do succeed a little bit at the beginning. But what happens in Japan is that there's so much attention to detail, and people, they just the same as the States in certain respects. They'll find out what your strengths and weaknesses are, and that word gets out very fast. And so a player may be susceptible to a forkball. A player may be susceptible to, you know, certain off speed pitches or a location of a fastball. And the difference between success and failure is Japanese pitchers are going to make that adjustment to you. There's no question. It's just when that takes place. And then it's up to that player to recognize that and then make that adjustment. And I think both of those players, I think the Japanese pitchers have begun to make that adjustment, and they've done very well to adjust to that. You know, and that can be helped by your teammates, Aoki, Yamada. Those players take going out of their way to make them feel welcome and to give them information. Coaching staff, Takatsu-san, you know, that kind of thing, and give them that information. And then it's really up to the player to make that adjustment. And sometimes you don't know. You have faith and you have confidence that player can make that adjustment. But really, in reality, you don't know, because failure, once you experience failure, it can be something where you can spiral out of control. And just fortunately, both those guys, and I've seen a lot of players do that. Fortunately, both the guys are good, solid guys. They work hard. Everything I've heard has been extremely positive, and they've obviously made little adjustments. And, you know, the quality of pitching in Japan is excellent. So it's a credit to those guys for, you know, mentally being prepared to make an adjustment. Also, I guarantee that they had to make some physical adjustments based on, you know, the success they've had.
Sure.
And adjustment of Japanese pitchers.
Yep. All right. Well, this team, you know, coming into the season, didn't have a lot of expectations from among the former NPB stars and some of the experts on TV and the other observers. Although I was one of the few people who didn't predict a last place finish for them. I had them in fourth. They're in third now. They're 10 games over 500. So how do you assess them so far in terms of wins and losses?
Well, I think it starts with leadership. I think with Takatsu-san and them at the top, I think that leadership is a huge factor. And I think we have talented players, but I also think that it's a lot of that leadership. And there really is just a buy-in from a lot of players on the team. You have Yamada and you have Murakami, you have Aoki, and, you know, at different levels, different stages of their career. But those guys are great leaders and they're out front. And then, you know, pitching wise, we don't have, there's some quality arms in there, but nobody that just rises above. So I think it's been a collective effort. And, you know, I just spending time with them, not this year, but the previous, just to see just a great atmosphere, a great enthusiasm and a willingness to work. I've just been really pleasantly surprised with, they've outperformed where I thought they would at this point in time, but it's a credit to them because, you know, you're looking talent wise. I think that, the talent is there. It's decent, but I believe that every single player has performed just a little bit above. And unfortunately, I don't get a chance to see them on a daily basis.
Yeah.
I do check the stats. I do watch what I can, but the limited time I spent around them in the previous camp and then talking with, you know, on our meetings and just about, you know, who I know the players that are there, definitely.
Yeah.
But there's a reason there. And I think every player is performing a little bit above their, where people maybe saw it. It's fun to watch. And, you know, that type of success is contagious. And so if Yamada-san, if he's all in and Aoki supports it and some of the pitchers and, you know, they're all in, it can, that atmosphere can bring up other players in the fringe, maybe some younger players that don't have the experience or, you know, maybe necessarily the confidence. It can bring everybody up.
Yeah. I don't know about the talent throughout the lineup even, and I did mention the fact that there's really no pitcher who is a lockdown or sure thing out there, and that might be something that holds the Swallows back as they try to finish this thing off in the second half and make the playoffs. But it's all great experience for a bunch of young players. Now I know I was figuring that you weren't watching a lot of the games, and I was sure that you get to see some of the footage of some of the guys playing or some of the games. But I was wondering what you thought of Takatsu as the manager and what has been important to his success this season.
I think with Takatsu-san, the big thing, like, there's a few different factors I believe that contribute to him being a great leader. First of all, is his experience. He is a calming personality, and I think the players feel comfortable around him.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't that fear factor that maybe some players feel with other Japanese prior managers, not necessarily with Yakult but other teams.
Mm-hmm.
But yet he has air about him that demands respect. So yes, he's a calming personality. Yes, he smiles. He's enjoyable to be around, but there's an air about him that does demand respect. And so I think what that does is allows the players to be relaxed, but yet know that there's some there's expectations and there's an accountability, and the players have to play, to work, they have to work hard and they have to do certain things. So I think it's a good, really good balance. And I think that comes too from Takatsu-san playing on both sides of the Pacific and seeing, having the different perspective. So he knows that there's a way that it's done in Japan, and he does hold those players accountable that way, but he's seen it in the United States as far as a player. So I just like that balance. I think that results in players being able to play relaxed, but also all players need to know that there's structure and there's rules and there's a way that, your work ethic has to the level of work ethic has to be every single day. So I think that's good. And I think that does also lead to, maybe some fringe players playing well or mm-hmm. solid, because they feel comfortable, as opposed to being petrified that if you make a mistake or something that, you're not going to be in the lineup. So I think it's, I think to have a leader like that and just from a player's perspective also, I think that you just play more loose, and when you play loose, you'll always play better.
Yep. Now, I often say that success isn't always measured in win-loss record because, for instance, you can have a team that doesn't really compete well one season and finishes in last, whereas you can have a team that's really close, they just don't have enough talent and finish in last, but they're keeping a lot of the games close, they're in the lead more often than they were the previous year, whatever it is. So now that you're on this side of the field, you're not between the lines, you're on the, let's say, the management side. What do you see as success when you look at the organization? Because you guys obviously have turned around the wins, losses, but it just looks different, too, on the field.
Yeah, it's a great question. And there really isn't a definite answer. But I also think that when you have a team that, like SoftBank, that has a lot of revenue and a lot of dollars to throw at aspects of your team, it can be quite easy. But you can still have the most talented group out on the field, and that doesn't necessarily translate. So, we talked about Takatsu-san, and you need that leadership. So, that if you have that vision where, you have a good manager and you're always going to have the best players, it's quite basic and quite easy. But it's a more challenging thing for some of the middle to the lower tier teams where, when you say success isn't necessarily measured there, there are different factors that come into it. For the Swallows, I think coming into the season, I think every team always has to believe that you're going to be, you're going to win. Everyone wants to win. But also, if you're realistic, as you said, the predictions are the Swallows being on the, the bottom or near the bottom of there. And it's, on paper, you just look at players and statistics. But then ultimately, the success that we've had is, there's factors that you just can't put your finger on. Desire, buy-in of a program, faith and confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And then, the team, to go down for our team, knowing that there's uncertainty going into a pandemic, and yet for them still to make sure that we have quality players and retain certain players like Yamada, who could have gone elsewhere. When a team shows that they're willing to do that, I think it I think as far as confidence and atmosphere, you know, with our team, with the Swallows, again, there's so many different things that come into it other than just talent. And I think you're right. I think pitching wise, we maybe don't have a defined, you know, stopper, maybe like another team, but you know, collectively everybody has to work together. And I think that's where the Swallows are going to be. And to get just really high talented personnel in your organization, the way some people do, you know, through the draft and stuff, that's like it's a slow turning thing. You can't change that overnight. And Swallows are never going to go out and buy, you know, or retain the top level free agents just because of finances.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, development within, development of and smart draft picks and developing those players and creating that atmosphere. That's what I, and then, you know, and then hopefully my job is, as far as getting quality players over to Japan, you know, for us to be successful year in and year out, you know, it depends on several different factors coming in. I think that's, it's fun. It's also a challenge because, unlike other teams that have a lot of resources and finances, you know, we don't have that luxury.
Right.
It makes it a little bit more of a challenge, but it's fun.
Okay. All right. Well, last question. When's your next trip to Japan?
As soon as they will let Tony and I go. It's Japan's the highlight of our year. I love it. The people, the city, the baseball, you know, it's exciting. Can't wait. But I also know, you know, talking with my director early in the week, it's I don't see it happening for a little while. But the moment they say, hey, Aaron, that's, you know, the door's open, we'd like for you to come, you know, I'll be there. But, you know, I think we're targeting, you know, potentially next spring. But I think that, you know, hopefully everything that's being done in Japan to, you know, mitigate the, you know, the pandemic and stuff, I think that's going to dictate it. But, you know, I hope it's soon. I hope it's soon. I definitely hope it's sooner rather than later.
All right. Well, let Jim and me know when you're coming, and hopefully we can get together with this pandemic. You know, we'll even if we have to stand between you stand in a phone booth and I stand outside of it and we talk, that'd be fun.
Yeah, I you know, for everybody, you know, I think it's baby steps. I just, you know, hope and pray for everybody and you know, Japan and over here, and it's definitely look forward to it, and hopefully it's this spring. So, you know, we'll look forward to seeing you and Jim for sure.
All right, thanks for your time this morning, much appreciated.
Yeah, sounds good. Nice talking with you. Take care.
Okay, same here. Bye-bye.
All right, so you know, Jim, I bet you pick up on the same points that I'm going to comment on, but please,
you go first. Oh, well, essentially, I love the question, first of all, about you know, what are the dynamics of scouting, you know, for this year as opposed to next year and in the future. I thought it was really good. I thought they did a great job of answering that, you know. And so hopefully, I don't think we're going to see anybody arriving soon. I think the Swallows have pretty much the guys they want, and then they're going to cross their fingers that Rick VandenHerck is going to be a positive solution.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I really enjoyed that, and I loved the discussion about the challenges of adapting to Japanese baseball. And it was, yeah, it's kind of, I'm pretty jaded because I'm so used to listen to Aaron break these things down in a way that make them very easy to understand.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I want to rave, but I've heard it so many times before that I can't really be surprised. But I did love that all about the different dimensions of the adjustments, and I certainly agree with. I agree with everything you said, really.
Hmm. Okay.
You?
I guess it was. Yeah, I guess I was wrong then. For me, it was the, you know, you said structure, rules, and level of work ethic, and those things are part of what Shingo Takatsu brings as a skipper. And I just love what he said about that. And you know, we tend to fixate on the game strategies and the moves and the wins and losses when we look at managers and we start to talk about them and we want to evaluate what they're doing and how they're doing and how the teams are doing. But I think what Aaron gave us was a little bit of insight into maybe getting players to perform at a level. Mm-hmm. And like I said, structure, rules, and level of work ethic, like you said. And I think those three, those things are so important because we don't get to see those things. We only see what the player does when the manager says, hey, so-and-so, go in and pinch hit. And the guy either gets a hit, even if he has a good or a bad at-bat, you know, we just look at the result. And so I don't think that's always how we should evaluate the managers, but those are the things we can see. We can't see the other things. But I think when he talked about the fact that, look, you get young players who come in, and the manager's job, obviously, when he gets a young player, is to sharpen that player's talent so that they can contribute, hopefully, to a winning situation. Mm-hmm. But I just really love what Aaron said about the fringe guys performing well when they're relaxed and not petrified. And you know, I know you've harped on this in the past, that sometimes the players are so scared to make mistakes that they're just playing tight. And I think something that Aaron said about one of the reasons maybe we're seeing some really, I wouldn't say great performances, but some contributions from players on the Swallows that we might not have expected. I mean, he did say they're basically performing above their pay grades, above their heads. But you need that kind of thing. You need that kind of contributions from some replacement players or spot starters or guys who come in to relieve and they're only going to be on the top team for the 10 days that some other pitcher is being quote-unquote rested on the farm. And you see the things that the Swallows have done this season in terms of getting production from just everybody who steps on the field. And so that's where I want to say, okay, maybe there were some pitching changes that I might not have made if I were Takatsu, or maybe there were some guys I wouldn't have sent up to pinch hit if I were Takatsu, or maybe there were some situations where I played the infield in, not back, or play halfway. But when you see how the players are all contributing, you know, I think it says, it just speaks levels about what he's doing where we can't see, you know. What's the phrase is that, what you do in the dark shines in the light. And I think behind the scenes that he's doing a lot of good things. And that's coming, you know, to fruition on the field with some of these players whose names we have trouble remembering because they don't play that much. We don't see them that often. They're up and down, they're elevator guys, or they're kicking around on the bench for eight innings. And then they come up and pinch run or pinch hit or come in as a defensive replacement and they contribute. So I just was impressed with all those aspects because that's, again, something we just don't look at and we can't see, but we don't take that into account when we're evaluating these managers. Well, you know, we can't say, well, you know, he had all his players ready to go. And I know everybody likes to use that phrase, the players were ready to play. Well, what does that mean? You know, what does that entail? That's not a one day thing or a pregame speech. You know, that is a lot more goes into having a guy ready. And I think that's what some of what we're seeing. And, you know, leadership, Aaron said leadership. And I think that's the main part that we can't see it all, but I think it's coming to fruition on the field for these guys.
Yeah, I think what you just said is really astute. And I think what you putting that in context with the Shingo Takatsu is really good, because Takatsu as a player was a character. Mm-hmm. He was a guy who, he was the guy who, you know, there's a famous Swallows story about Rex Hudler losing his, essentially getting kicked out of Japan while being a productive player by Katsuya Nomura because he ate an earthworm in practice. And Shingo Takatsu was behind that. He was the one who was basically daring people to eat an earthworm. And Jack Howell wouldn't do it, but he said, wait a second, I know somebody who might. So Jack told that story on I'm trying to remember where. I guess it was in with Asaya Nomura. Nomura's granddaughter did a chat. We had a Twitter chat a year ago or so. Anyway, so he was also the guy when Tetsuya Iida, the center fielder, went out with an injury when the Swallows were, you know, a powerhouse in the 1990s, and all the players who were like wearing two, you know, they had like magic marker, they had a two on their uniform for Iida, and instead of a two, Shingo Takatsu put two black dots on his cap, because Tetsuita has moles. Because he's two moles, and so he put two black dots on his cap. But that's the kind of person he was as a player. But I absolutely agree. I know I've commented before that he reminds me a lot of Akihiro Yano, and that he has kind of the strict manager's face,
right?
But he doesn't live with it. You know, he basically you.
What, it's like a hat.
Yeah, exactly. It's just part of the uniform. Mm-hmm. And that the real him is the guy who's, I don't want to say he gets the players ready to play, but he has the players ready to get themselves. He and his coaches have the players ready to get themselves prepared. And my analysis of the Swallows, and you know, and is not that, I don't know if they're playing above their heads, but part of that is true. They're playing up to their potential. I think a lot of guys are playing up to their potential. And I'm going to get into the more of the details later. But what the Swallows are sort of the antithesis of the they're not the California Angels anymore, are they? They're the Los Angeles Angels.
Los Angeles, Anaheim Angels of California, or Los Angeles.
The Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, in the sense that they're a team with like two of the best players in the world, maybe the two best players in the world. And unlike the kids in Wet Lake Wobegon, Minnesota, almost everybody is below average.
Yeah.
You know, this is a team that basically is bad everywhere except a few key spots. And the Swallows are a team which have a handful of really good players, and then they have virtually nobody who's bad. I mean, they got a bunch of guys who are pretty close to, you know, a league average. And, you know, their worst guys are the guys who are not really bad, not really great, but not really bad. They have nobody dragging them down. So that's you know, it's an unusual team, and so you know you don't look at the depth of, you know, the big name stars of the Murakami and Yamada, but and I think the pitching's better than, well, you know, in Jingu the pitching is better than people think it is.
I would agree with that 100%.
I think the pitching is really their strength this year. So anyway, that's my take on that. But I certainly agree with you about Takatsu and also with Aaron that there is a leadership there. And, you know, the guys who – the Swallows have a lot of rookies who are contributing at a fairly productive level. And a lot of them we don't know of because, you know, they're guys who've been pros for a few years who had few opportunities. One guy's a pitcher. I think he was there. His name escapes me. He was a second round draft choice, and he had Tommy John a couple of years ago, and he's come out and he's been good. And you know, that's sort of like these guys coming out of nowhere and producing at a very consistent level. And that's really been the Swallows.
Yeah, I agree. I talked about the fact that they don't have that ace pitcher, and then we had Yasunobu Okugawa come out and pitch a really good game tonight against the Bay Stars. And yeah, he has been good in his recent starts and seems to have figured out the art of pitching, not just throwing. And that could bode well for this team. And they won again today. They're 11 games over 500 as we speak. And again, you say the pitching is probably the best. I think they're just balanced. I think if you look at that team, it is one of the more balanced teams in Japan, not just the Central League. Not that it hits a lot, not that it pitches great, it just does everything adequately enough so that every night there's a chance to win the game and somebody has a chance to make a play or make a pitch. And they've been getting a lot more done than not, and especially in the past couple of years. So It's fun to see. And like I said before, we have a water and oil situation with the Central League. It's like, you know, the Dragons came out, they lost these first three games after this long break. So they're pretty much, if anybody has a fork you can lend us, we'll stick it in them for you. But I can see the Carp and the Bay Stars making a move before I see the Dragons going anywhere. But the Swallows, I don't think they're coming back to the pack. So here we are in August, and it looks like we have our playoff series basically set, except for the top two, and then, you know, that's up for grabs as well. And I wouldn't, you know, I don't think the Swallows can win it, but I'm going to say with the other teams, you know, if they get good results against the other two teams, and the other two teams beat each other up, they have as good a chance as anybody.
Well, right before the break, you know, I'd been telling everybody who would listen, which is, you know, both of them, that the
I listen to you, Jim. I do.
Oh, well, I won't tell you who the other person is. I don't want to dox them, you know. So the so I was saying how bad the Swallows were against the, you know, basically they've been, their record is from beating up on DeNA and Hiroshima and Chunichi and losing to the Tigers and Giants. But then right before the break, they beat the bejesus out of the Giants. So that was kind of fun if you're a Swallows fan. But, you know, they showed, you know, you never know. I don't think they're a bad team, but I think they've been under, you know, they have had that sort of issue with the Giants for one reason or another. And, you know, if we see them play them very tough, you know, lose closer games and maybe win more, because they beat them up pretty good in a couple of those games. And if we see more of that, then I wouldn't put it past them to make a surprise in the postseason. Right now, yeah. I don't see it, but could happen.
It could happen. All right. Well, thanks again to Aaron Guile. Yeah. Always appreciate having him on the show. And he said, hey, anytime, John. Again, reiterated, he's willing to come on as many times as we need him. So that's awesome.
Thanks a lot for getting the interview.
All right. So it was back to work, making a seamless transition back to work for the 12 teams. Essentially, we only had 5 games scheduled on Friday after this long break, which was perplexing to me. But anyway, as the teams came back into the resumption of the season, all 12 wore black ribbons on their sleeves for Chunichi's fallen pitcher, Yusuke Kinoshita. We reported or told you last week that he had passed away after having collapsed early in July and struggling in the hospital for all that time. So the Dragons hung his 98 jersey. I think it's number 98. I didn't see the jersey. I actually saw the jersey on the broadcast, but I didn't remember that it was 98, so I had to look it up. But they hung it in the dugout. And like I said, it was pretty tacky looking, if you ask me. They just put a safety pin with a black ribbon on there. I thought they could have done a little bit better, but maybe it was kind of spur of the moment and difficult for all the teams to do the same thing. So they wanted all the teams to be in unison or doing the same thing with the ribbon. So they used safety pins, which I guess that's what it ended up being. But it was a nice gesture, I thought, from all the teams to do that. And, you know, we rarely have this situation in any sport, really. But I don't remember too many happening in Japanese baseball. What about you?
No, I mean,
have an active player. I mean, he hadn't, really didn't do much. He'd been injured all the time this whole season, so he hadn't pitched on the top team.
No, I don't really know. I don't recall. I guess the one I'd have to look back on was when the Giants coach dropped dead.
Right. Yeah, that's the last time
we had Kimura.
Right. Yeah, we had that. And that was quite a bit ago, maybe 10 years ago.
It was about 12. Let's see, it was right. It was right after about the time Mazda Stadium was opening, or maybe the last year of Hiroshima Shinin Kyujo.
So. Okay, so we were going to talk about our impressions coming out of these 3-game series, and I thought, the most impressive thing I saw came on Friday night when Yuki Yanagita of the Hawks rose from the bed and finished an at bat with a 2-run homer to help the Hawks from the because I say the bit because he hit himself with a foul ball and he hit it, it looked like right off the kneecap, and he couldn't even get off the field on his own power. He had to get help to get to the dugout, and so I'm sure they put him on the bed back there in the treatment room and looked at the knee and did something to it, and he comes back walking back out swinging a bat, and he gets back into the batter's box and hits a home run to finish that at bat and played, you know, the rest of the game. And I'm thinking, you know, I don't know if this guy's human, if he's going to do this kind of stuff. And that was just really impressive, for me. His 23rd home run with opposite field shot, and he followed that up with a single in his next trip to the plate. I mean, what a player! What an effort!
Yeah, he had a good line in his Hero interview. He says, "I think I had a lot stored up after not doing anything during the Olympics. So I had some left in. I had a home run left in storage."
So sticking with the Hawks, and then another impressive thing was Carter Stewart Jr. getting his first start in Japan as a top team pro, and mm-hmm. probably a spot start. I don't know, but you had talked about it. It was so timely that you talked about it last week, saying that he had been pitching well on the farm. And so he goes up against the Fighters today and has a career day in Japan. He strikes out 9 with no walks. He did hit a batter, but we'll forgive him for that. And then he starts a combined no-hitter that featured 6 Hawks pitchers, but nobody won. It was a 0-0 stalemate, and I had the volume off on this game. I had it on. I was watching. I didn't even realize that he hadn't given up a hit. I didn't realize the rest of the pitchers, none of those guys gave up a hit. And it wasn't until I looked on Twitter sometime around 6:30 or so that I saw that it was a no, not 6:30 or so, but a little bit before that, maybe after 5, and saw that it was a no-hitter combined. And, of course, they don't make any kind of fanfare about combined no-hitters, especially when there's no decision in the game. And so the Fighters really great put out a great effort as well. They had 5 pitchers combined on a 3-hitter, so a dual shutout. It was great pitching. Great pitching in Fukuoka today.
Yeah, it was sort of like, the perfect storm for the Fighters because they didn't score a run in that series.
I didn't even realize that.
Yeah, and they struck out, Shuta Ishikawa struck out 11 on Friday.
Right, and Higashiyama
struck out a career-high 11 on Saturday. And the six guys on Sunday, I think, combined for 13 strikeouts.
Good grief.
Yeah, and the Hawks struck out a bunch too. So I haven't counted them, but there was probably close to 60. There were probably more than 65 strikeouts in that 3-game series.
Wow. And a lot of breeze.
Yeah, there was a lot of fanage going on. So another interesting little thing, and since I mentioned Yuki Inagita in the Japan Olympic team, that this in the bottom of the eighth inning on Sunday, the Hawks had their best chance. They had a single against Brian Rodriguez, and then a stolen base by Ukyo Shuto, and a sacrifice brought him to third, and then they had. The miracle, the Samurai Japan miracle hitter, Takuya Kai, who was instrumental in both of their walk-off wins, mm-hmm. come from behind walk-off wins against the Dominican Republic where he bunted, and then against the U.S. where they brought in 5 infielders to defend against the bunt and he hit it to the wall.
Mm-hmm.
So,
on the bounce, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he hit it into the outfield. So the expectations were running high and he was looking for a bunt and everything was set for that. And they unfortunately tried a suicide squeeze and Brian Rodriguez bounced the pitch. So the Hawks announced.
Fortunately for him, yeah. And they caught it the way they stopped
it. Right.
Yeah.
They caught it. And so they hung up Shuto to dry. On the third baseline is a caught stealing of home, and the thing that caught me out of that was that happens, but was the announcer and the analyst Kazumi Saito, the former Hawks ace, said that's the thing with suicide squeeze bunts they're risky, but what they meant was they're risky because the pitchers, you can't depend on pitchers always throwing the ball where they can be bunted. But he didn't, that's what he was talking about. What he didn't mean was the fact that there's all kinds of other risks, like the bunter doesn't get the ball down or, there's all other kinds of things. But they were making it sound like the only problem, crime comedy movie, where the criminals go, well, the only thing that can go wrong is, we're late. And this is like, what about the police? Okay, the only things that could go wrong are the late we could be late or it could be the police. What about the weather? Okay, shut up.
There's
all kinds of things that can go wrong, but you know, they want to make it sound like everybody always executes when they don't and blah, 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 blah. But that's sort of the way they treat bunts in Japan. So.
Right, right. And then I thought the Tigers coming out of the break and getting blasted in their first game by the Carp, that was it looked bad. They ended up winning the series 2-1. They won 9-3 on Saturday and 3-0 today. But I thought, and here's something else I kind of noticed, but I thought that pitchers or teams would come out with their best rotation if they could. Some of the pitchers were on the Samurai Japan team, mm-hmm. so they needed extra rest or they couldn't come out firing on Friday. And there was no game scheduled for the Yakult Swallows and Bay Stars on Friday, so they weren't on the schedule. But it just seemed like the teams were not throwing their best pitchers coming out of this. In fact, I mean, we saw Louis Okoye of the Rakuten Eagles playing at MetLife Dome. He was starting, and you know, I hadn't really been watching him on the farm, so I immediately jumped to the idea that maybe they're showcasing him to trade him or try to get something. But what is it that the Eagles need? They need right-handed power hitting. I don't know where they're going to get that if they trade Okoye. But I thought, well, we all know what he can do. But he looks so much different. I don't know if you got a chance to see him at all this past weekend, but he's filled out a little bit more. He's changed his approach at the plate, less movement. That front leg stays down a little bit longer. You know, he looks like a different player, but still I didn't see him hitting for power. We know he's really strong and he has gotten bigger, but I couldn't figure that out. The Dragons didn't seem to start with their best pitchers, although they went out with Yariel mm-hmm. Rodriguez on Friday, and he had killed the Giants in his first year. So I guess they were hoping for a little bit more of that magic, but he didn't look, yeah, he didn't look terrible. He didn't hit his spots consistently and gave up some runs early. And then Yoshihiro Maru hit two home runs off of him. So he gave some runs early and in the middle, and then he was gone. But, yeah, the Dragons didn't look that good at all anyway.
No, I like the fact that Yariel Rodriguez was back. I like the fact that Ariel Martinez was
the Cuban,
back behind the plate. Yeah, the so Cuban they're going to have – yeah, I mean, that's some catching – questions. You know, it's like the Dragons were the team that no one expected them to ever have a catcher. You know, we'd sort of resigned ourselves to the fact that this franchise has decided that catcher is a position that we're just not going to have a regular, like forever.
Forever.
And now they've got these guys who can really play.
Remember, they traded Takuma Kato, who was starting for the Marines tonight, and I thought that was odd.
Yeah, I mean, they got some talented catcher, so, you know, who may go figure.
Yeah.
So, no, I saw that. I saw a lot of guys. Of course, Louis Okoye was making his first start of the season. We had a lot of people coming back who we haven't seen in a long time. The Hawks game. The last, you know, Carter Stewart was lighting it up, and you know, we expect him to throw 157 kilometers per hour. But the guy, the pleasant surprise and the most pleasant surprise in that game was Hiroshi Kino coming back.
Yes,
and he was. I think he might have thrown 158 in the ninth inning, and this is a guy who was hurt in spring training of 2019.
Mm-hmm.
He hasn't pitched since 2018.
Man, oh man, yeah, and I don't remember what the injury was. Was it he had?
No, he got hurt, and then he had surgery. He got hurt himself in rehab last year, and he had surgery. You know, so that was really neat, and to see that. So yeah, it was pretty fun stuff. I guess the big thing was the Fighters, who sort of like. You know, they were giving up, but they're just struggling right now. It's hard to watch.
It is, but I mean, they were really competitive. These games, they were good, and Naoyuki Uwasawa was really good. I mean, he was just unlucky, and but he could have easily won that game. And today, Kato was the starter.
Yesterday, Saturday.
Was it? Well, who started today?
Drew Verhagen.
Oh, that's right, Drew. That's right. There were three. That's right.
Yeah, they had a guy go three innings today. It's like, geez, 33 pitches in three innings. Well, let's get rid of him.
Hashtag high heat.
Move on, move on. Nothing to see here.
Yeah, so they got pretty good pitching, and they didn't. I would say the Hawks won these games, but the Fighters didn't give them away or lose them or anything. It just, and I mean, I'm saying these games that they didn't win today. It was a tie. So, yeah, really, really, really good stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Fighters don't look good, and I don't expect them to get better. And we'll talk about it a little bit later. They've got some in-house fighting, literally. So they've got other issues besides trying to win games.
The Fighters, I suppose.
Where there you go. Get some boxing gloves on those guys. But all right, well, let's make a four-seam transition and talk about Rockin' with Roki. And Roki Sasaki of the Lotte Marines got the start on Sunday at home. And yes, he served up a two-run homer to Adam Jones in the second inning in the rain. But then he kind of settled down, and I didn't get to see a lot of the pitches. I was mostly listening to the TV broadcast with Tomoya Satozaki on the mic doing the color commentary. But it was in the fourth inning, Yutaro Mashmash Sugimoto lined a ball off of Sasaki's right ankle, and I thought, okay, well, there's no reason to push this young guy out there because I heard it. I mean, you could hear the sound of the bat, and then you heard this kind of a thud sound that sounded like ball on bone. That's exactly what it sounded like. And he got it out on the play. The ball went to Brandon Laird at first base, and who recorded the out. But Sasaki could not – again, he was a guy, couldn't get off the field on his own power, wasn't really putting a lot of weight on that leg, and then all of a sudden he didn't want to put any weight on it. Guys helped him back to the locker room, and then he kind of gingerly moved back out to the mound, and they sent him out there, and I just thought, this is just wrong. But he got the out in that inning, the last out in that inning, and he retired the side in the fifth, and then they took him out. And in the meantime, Koki Yamaguchi hit a two-run homer to put the Marines in position to win. They were up 3-2 at that point, and Sasaki left the game, but the bullpen couldn't hold it, and the Marines end up losing 5-3, or you could say that the Buffaloes, the first place Buffaloes, looked like a first place team. They took 2 out of 3 in this series. It was, and it's on the road, so they look. This is the place where they lost 6 in a row last year. Am I right? In those 6-game series, so they look good. But I just didn't think there was any need to push Sasaki back out there. But Skipper Higuchi did. It was weird.
It's kind of ironic. You know, here's a guy that they've been treating like the crown jewels.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, like, okay, can you see my face? Yeah, you see where the mound is? Yeah. Oh, what are you doing here? Get out on the mound.
Get your butt out there.
Exactly.
Yeah, I didn't really understand that. I still don't. And I didn't wait around to see comments and stuff from the managers or the bench guys or the pitching coaches or anybody, because somebody gets hit that hard and is limping, there's really, you know, no reason to send him out there. So, yeah, you said it right. They're treating him like the crown jewel, and all of a sudden they dropped him on the floor, and now he's not worth as much. Ah, he scratched. So, wow. Yeah, and they end up losing that game and losing the series. But, not looking so good for my Marines have an opportunity to win this this Pacific League title, but it's a long way to go still. They just don't have the pitching, the arm, the ace, that one guy who can go out there and give the other team fits every week. And I think other teams, the teams above them, have at least one of those guys, and that might be their downfall. Although you talked about the fact that the Buffaloes don't have the bullpen, maybe. But
their bullpen is a little shallow, yeah.
Yeah, but Taisuke Yamaoka, I heard on the broadcast that he might be pitching out of the bullpen shortly. So,
yeah, we expected that because of the acquisition of Glenn Sparkman.
I don't know if I expected it, but somebody's got to go and somebody's coming in. So,
well, I mean, I could see that the bullpen has been, you know, it looks objectively like the bullpen is bad. My colleague who covers the Buffalo said the bullpen is bad. Tyler Higgins has been better. and Yoshihisa Urano has been pretty steady. But when your starting pitching is really good and your offense is really good and your defense is not bad, well, and the bullpen isn't, well, it seems like, you know, somebody's going to find their way to the bullpen.
Well, I have objections with the phrase pretty steady, because either you're steady or you're not. I don't know if there are levels.
Oh, okay.
But that's okay. But I mean, you know, people like to say that, but
He's been effective more times than not, so I'll give him the benefit of the doubt.
I will too. He has been a guy who at least they can say, well, we're going to give you the ball in the ninth and we're living with you, and yeah, he can handle it.
And it's not like they're going to put Hiroshi Masui in the bullpen and see how this works, you know. So we'll keep you around as a starter. Don't worry, you're not going anywhere. In fact, almost like he starts walking for the bullpen, and they say, "Hold on a second, buddy. No, it's not over there.
You're going the wrong way.
Exactly, wrong way. Starters this way." They figure you can do less damage as a starter.
They figure. But, yeah, he did pitch out of the bullpen tonight, and he was, I mean, you know, only one hit and one walk, so it was minor trouble, but he got out of it. So, yeah, props to Zenshi Masui, my buddy. All right, so, and Masahiro Tanaka was one of those players who pitched with the Samurai Japan team, so we didn't see him this weekend, but I expect to see him, especially after Hideaki Wakui was giving away runs like he was a food server. today. So we might, I saw some of that game. I'm not sure what it was that was going wrong for Wakui, but he just didn't have much of anything going on. And it's a long break. I expect that we're going to see a little bit of this. We're going to see some unevenness coming out of the break, where some guys handled it really well. Some guys got a lot of rest. Some veteran guys got the rest they needed. Some young guys got some at bats that they needed. But not everybody starting off at the same starting point, so to speak. I think we're going to see some unevenness with these starts.
Yeah, the fun thing about that Lions-Eagles series was the Lions got to face two former Lions aces. And one of them
Takayuki.
Yeah, Takayuki Kishi kicked him from here to MetLife Dome. And they did the same to Hideaki Wakui, so...
yeah, that was bad. But yeah, Kishi did look good the other night. Okay, making a two-seam transition, the show must move on. Or is it go on? I don't know. But Sho Nakata of the Fighters, and we did bring this up earlier, so we'll get into it here. I saw a story this past week that said he had gotten into a scrape, a fracas with a teammate, and the details were sketchy. And then I saw another story that said it was a pitcher whom they are referring to as Pitcher A, a teammate in his 20s, but they didn't identify the person with whom he got into this fracas. And then I hadn't seen anything after that, but there was speculation as to who it was, and maybe it wasn't a pitcher, and there was talk about it being somebody else, and maybe somebody he had a close relationship with on the team. But then I saw a story today that said Nakata kind of picks on some of the younger players, and that player with whom he got into this scuffle, or whatever you want to call it, is not the only one who has a problem with Nakata on the team. So this looks like a problem that has festered and is now starting to manifest itself in fisticuffs. We're going to settle this like men. Big, stupid men. I don't know what's going on. What did you hear?
I heard very little, I did not hear much about it. I was just pretty much focusing on the details that were confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
So... The interesting thing was the initial team comments were the player didn't want to make the player who was the victim of the assault. I mean, we call it an assault. We don't know, you know, how much battery took place. But, you know, if you go after somebody, it is an assault, even if you don't make contact.
OK,
so the victim of the assault didn't want to make a big deal about it. And Nakata apologized to the player and said it was 100% his fault. But the team still said, okay, given that, we're going to suspend you indefinitely. Yeah. So what that tells me is this was not the start. You know, this is, was not the first thing. And the other thing I will add is that Nakata has had a couple of – he's had some physical issues this year. He's had an issue with not getting good results with his bat. And he had that little spat with manager Hideki Kuriyama where he was frustrated with himself and he came back to the dugout and he threw his bat at the Sapporo Dome dugout. And it came back and I think the knob of the bat hit him in the eye.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
And so he was unable to play and Kuriyama was tired of reporters asking him about what's wrong with Nakata and says, why don't you just ask him? Ask that moron, you know, kind of thing. So, yeah, I don't want to pretend I know what's going on there. Kuriyama's, although he's a very keen self-promoter, he's still a very smart guy, and he's often likes to keep things sort of in the dark and, you know, not going to tell people what's going on. So I don't know.
Yeah, and the report I read also said that after the incident happened, Nakata went out and had one at bat, and when management found out what happened through communications during the game, management, and we're talking about team management, so the front office said, well, we want to send him home, take him out of the game and send him home. Mm. So that makes what you said about this not being the first time that they've stepped up the level of punishment to impact the bad behavior or said behavior that they want to, it might not be bad, it just might not be productive or it might be detrimental to the team, right? It doesn't have to be bad. It just has to be detrimental. They want to curb that behavior. And so they send him home. So that, yeah, I think you're right about it not being the first time and they're stepping up the level to impact that behavior. So we'll keep an eye on this. But, he hasn't really played well. But, you know, we're coming off a season in which he hit 31 home runs last year. And I kept saying, well, you know, he is productive with the bat. He didn't hit very well. He hit .239, but had more than 100 RBIs, had 18 doubles. He played in 119 games, 500-plus at-bats. So, obviously was a player who was contributing enough to get, you know, more playing time. And I'm sure the expectations were higher than the 193 that he's hitting this year. And he was sent to the farm. And that might be some frustration on his part that, you know, I can understand it. You know, you're down on the farm where you thought as a young player, you'd never be back. And maybe there's just no, I mean, it could be the frustration of not knowing when he was going to be back on the top team. So, Whatever it is, I'm sure we'll get more details, especially because another story I read said that the players, some of the older, the former fighters think that they should just move on from him and just let him go. And so that's why I titled this segment, The Show Must Move On, because with a question, because some of the players were saying that, and that's out there. So not well liked.
The fighters have been, you know, they've basically made him one of the faces of the franchise, you know, about 12 years ago. And
along with Handkerchief Prince.
Hashtag high.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, speaking of people that have been around for like no real...
We're taking charge of some of that bad behavior.
Objective reason why I don't think there's bad behavior on his part. But the fighters have gone a long way as an organization. They've, you know, when Trey Hillman, I think it was his first year, he threatened to quit when he found out that the minor league manager had punched out one of the players.
Right.
And, you know, and he said, look, you've got to do something about that or I'm gone. You know, and the fighters went, okay, this is no longer acceptable. You know, so they changed. And the fact that the front office stepped up and almost, I wonder, I think this is the front office leadership that's doing this. I think you're right. I think that they're the ones. I don't know the fighters team philosophy is essentially that Kuriyama does what, you know, he wants with the players that we give him. You know, he runs the team how he sees fit with the players that we supply him with, but we're in charge. And, but there's also things like, you know, Kotaro Kiyomiya being essentially banished to the farm team.
Yeah, we haven't heard a peep out of him either.
Right. So he was sort of like the next Nakata. You know, he was going to be the guy who was going to be everything. But the fighters, and I've also mentioned in the past, the fighters have had trouble getting guys who've been minor league standouts. It's taken them a long time to make those adjustments to playing in the very extreme conditions of the Pacific League and that tremendous pitcher's park they play in.
Right.
So I don't know how all this shifts together and, you know, and the team not playing well and whatever it is, but yeah, it's just another sort of, it's sort of like a game of Clue, you know. I don't know. I don't think we're going to find out whether it was, Professor Mustard in the kitchen with the
ketchup.
I think it was with the garlic press
or the pickle. All right, let's move along, though. Huh? Yeah, we hopefully we will hear more about this and we'll get more to you. And finally, making a one seam transition, the fastest pitch in MPB history was thrown with little fanfare on Saturday against the poor little Dragons. The Giants, Thiago Vieira out of Brazil. Yeah. He was, tormented the Dragons in the ninth inning with an array of fastballs and one hit a Japan record 166 kilometers per hour. That's slightly over 103 miles per hour. Mm-hmm. And, didn't really see much on the news. Didn't really hear too much. Jim, before we went on mic, said he blogged about it. I knew that. I didn't have time to read it, but I did know. Right. And then, but I didn't really see that much. Everybody just kind of said ho hum, and I didn't like that because I thought if it were one of the little media darling guys who had thrown it, they would have been all over it. So I wasn't. Wasn't happy with the lack of attention given to this big happening. You know, it wasn't a Japanese guy. I think when Mark Kroon hit the speed mark, quote unquote, right. I think that was your headline when he did it. He was a bigger figure in Japanese baseball and more respected after coming over from Yokohama. But Vieira has been a guy, he's wild thing. He's wild thing, and the Giants have harnessed that, and they've been able to get him to find the plate with some of his pitches. And even though he throws straight, he throws really hard, and he has developed into a really nice closer for them. It's really impressive what the Giants have done and what he has done working on his pitching. And I would have liked to have seen more. Maybe everybody, including us, we were just tired with all the Olympic stuff that had just finished. We weren't ready for this to suddenly happen. I don't know what it was, but it just didn't get a lot of play.
Right. And it was, I don't know if it was because he broke Shohei Ohtani's speed record or what, or yeah, just sort of brush it. But the whole thing with him has been sort of his evolution as the Giants closer has, you know, he wasn't, you know, Ruby De La Rosa is supposed to be the closer, and he just kind of, he ran out of gas this year, and so Vieira and Ruby De La Rosa does not look like really a happy camper being pitching in the eighth inning. And I don't know what it is, but it's sort of like, yeah, Vieira's here, and okay, he pitched, and you know, he hit the speed record, okay, but we had a really, you know, interesting game otherwise, and yeah.
Blah blah blah. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Even the Giants aren't making a big deal about it, and the Giants sort of like, you know, you really need sedatives to keep the Giants from making big deals about things.
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of weird. But I did. Nikon Sports did a little graphic on the locations and the years where the recent fastest pitches have been thrown, and Tokyo Dome appears on this list twice. What other dome, hint, hint, has been the place where pitchers have thrown the fastest pitches in recent years.
My guess would be Sapporo Dome.
You are correct. Yeah.
What a surprise, since Shohei Ohtani pitched there so often.
Yeah, it was Ohtani. Ohtani was he's on the list once.
Oh.
But it's not him. Yeah, all these times. It's Robert Suarez with the Tigers. Edwin Escobar of the Yokohama Bay Stars. And Reed Garrett of the Saber Lions. Yeah. All in Sapporo Dome. None of them fighters. It's kind of weird. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I'm just wondering if the air is a little bit thinner up there. But
Well, the guys certainly, I know the mound is a lot of the players like the mound there. And maybe it's like, you know, Jingu used to have a reputation for a fast, you know, for setting the radar gun high, because the college players like to have, you know, higher velocities.
Right, show up so they can get drafted.
That,
yeah,
and that was accounted that used to be accounted for Ryota Igarashi when he set a speed record back in the day.
Yeah, I see. All right, let's go to fielding questions. So I was digging around in my email the other day because I actually had like about 5 minutes of free time.
Wow.
five minutes.
I know. I'm going like, wow, dude, you're like a superhero. You got 5 minutes.
Yeah. And I thought I had missed a question, and I was looking through and I did some searches with the high heat in the email, and I did searches on the Twitter account with the hashtag high heat and all that stuff. And I found another email from MPB card guy, Dave, in Baltimore. And he said, "Hope things are going all right and you and everyone else are staying safe through all this. I had a quick question for you for the podcast, although it's not really about baseball. The past year and a half, the Japanese government has been kind of downplaying the pandemic because it wanted to hold the Olympics. So what happens when the Olympics are over? Does the government finally get religion?" Great question. Very timely, since the Olympics are over now. So, Jim, your opinion?
Gee, I don't know. I mean, we're going to have an election soon. So, you know, my guess is that Mr. Suga will either say yes and let's, you know, have the best coronavirus response we can have, because the Olympics are over and we'll pretend we've been doing it all along. You know, that would be the best one. Or he can double down and do a Trump, which is we've done a great job, and if we weren't here, millions of people would be dead.
Well, you know, I looked at it. I think it's a good way to find it's a good way to put it, Dave. You said get religion, because I think the spiritual side of Japan or Japanese culture has really been dissipating for decades. And when I came to Japan, of course, I was in Nagoya, so it was different, but there just seemed to be more people who had more of a spiritual presence. I don't know if you felt that when you were in Japan, when you first came to Japan in the 80s, Jim, but it seems like there's an overall lack of that now. It might be because of all these electronics and these devices that we have in our hands. We don't have any time to think and do things that are not, you know, related to something else, and work on ourselves. We need to work on ourselves more a lot of times. And I think that folks don't have this spiritual side. And I sensed less and less as I've been in Japan that the people have spiritual side. So to address the question directly, with no real event on the agenda and the Paralympics are just not the same, I think the government stays in heathen mode for the time being. The whole Olympics thing, I think they were downplaying it. Yes, because they wanted to hold the games and they wanted to get whatever money that was going to be available to get, even though they weren't going to have fans and all the other things that ended up happening and the way it played out. But you know, during the Olympics, the infection rate hit an all-time high. It was never higher than when we had the games. So I don't know. I don't know if it was related, not related. I just don't know. The inoculations were slowed because the vaccine rollout was more like a drip out. they even ran out. I mean, it's a mess here. It's a real mess. get religion. I think maybe religion's the only thing that could save this situation. You know, just pray, because we still have people who have not been. There's a person at work has their temp, so they're not. You understand the situation, Jim, but they're temporary. Mm-hmm. They're temp workers, so they don't really work for our company, and they don't really work for their own company, and they're kind of in limbo. And these people have had trouble getting to vaccine lines or mm-hmm. their city offices or their town offices and getting help because they're too young. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, you know, a lot of people around us are having no trouble getting vaccinations. It's just a mishmash. It's just double talk, jibber jabber, and all that other stuff, lip service to go with it. So, and the public is not taking this thing seriously. Like I said, the train stations, in my opinion, they should increase the number of trains per hour and tape off some of the seats so that people are not sitting shoulder to shoulder and people don't have to crowd into trains every day to go to work when we really shouldn't even be, you know, everyone who could telework and telecommute, they should all be doing so. But yet we've got packed trains all the time. You know, it's not just the government's fault. So everyone has to take responsibility as well. So it's just really a mess, Dave. So yeah, religion, yes. Somebody needs to get some religion and pray and hope that we can get through this. And that's my piece.
the whole thing, I guess the question boils down to, if you're going to have a real effective response, you have to deal with the truth. You know, you have to deal with the truth in this is the way it is, and this is what we're going to do, and this is the real thing. And pretty much governments don't want to deal with the truth because it's not convenient. And I doubt that we're going to see that real, you know, sort of like, this is the real situation. This is exactly how bad it is. This is what you need to do kind of thing, because that will point out the problem with the truth is it points out what you have been doing wrong in the past, which is sort of like the scientific method.
Right.
The scientific method is always, you know, this is the best thing we know, so we're going to do this. And then the information changes and you say, no, we were wrong about this. We're going to do this. Which is, if you're a MAGA type, it means, well, you changed your story about masks. You changed your story about this. Well, yes, because in knowledge and, you know, it's not knowledge, it's information. It's the best we've got. But if you can't deal with the fact that you were wrong and that being wrong is part of the process, and then you become, well, we can't be wrong, so let's do the best we can without admitting we were wrong. And that's probably the course Japan's government's going to take.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, Dave. So you opened up a can of worms there for us.
Indeed, but, you did. Hold on. There's a couple crawling on me.
Thank you very much for the question. We appreciate it. Anyone else with a question or comment, hit us up on Twitter at JBW Podcast with the hashtag #HighHeat. Send questions and MP3 questions via email to yakyujohn@gmail.com or hit us up on the Facebook page where you can leave us a comment. And like I said, topics to talk about, other things that you want to hear, suggestions for the show, anything at all. We will talk to you next week, and hopefully it'll be warmer and a lot less rainy. Enjoy your baseball.
See you at the ballpark.
Follow the hosts on Twitter at JBW Podcast and at JBallAllen. And feel free to submit your questions by email or tweet with hashtag #HighHeat. Thank you for listening to Japan Baseball Weekly.